Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Amnesty International is calling for accountability within the Papua New Guinea security forces. This comes after 17 unarmed prisoners were shot and killed while trying to escape from the Bumio prison in Liai. Amnesty has called for officers involved in the killings to be suspended and for an independent inquiry to be held. But the group-specific researcher, Kate Schulze, says it is unlikely that any of those involved will ever be reprimanded, let alone tried, for their actions. She told Karori Hawkins the tragic incident highlights the broader systematic issue.
I think this needs to be understood in the long history of that prison, which there's been various reports in the past about overcrowding, unsanitary conditions, the long periods of time that people are being held on remand, therefore, in some cases up to 9 years. So there's been various internal Papua New Guinean government reports, as well as human rights inquiries. Human Rights Watch has also reported on the prison around 10 years ago. And last year we had 12 people who were shot dead after escaping from that same prison. This year we've seen another tragic incident of a much larger scale. So I think what this highlights is that there's some broader systemic issues around conditions in that prison which haven't been addressed. And then, of course, it's been met with lethal force by the prison's officials when people have attempted to escape those harsh conditions.
It's just like you can't imagine. These are unarmed people trying to escape, as you say, and they're being shot by prison officials. Has that been confirmed? It's officials that have shot them and not police?
Yes, it is. It is officials who have shot them. And the response we've seen from Papua New Guinean authorities to date really has been to blame the detainees themselves, whilst at the same time they've also acknowledged that many of those being held in the prison haven't yet been convicted of any crime, but they are actually stating to the public that these people are dangerous. But of course, if they're escaping prison, there's no evidence to suggest that they were armed, but firearms have been used to shoot and kill those people, which is a tragic incident.
And what action has Amnesty called for before in relation to this, and what action are you calling for now?
Of course this incident has to be independently investigated, and the officers involved must be held accountable for those killings. But I think now this highlights that there's a broader systemic issue in relation to accountability for all of the security forces in PNG. You know, we're hearing of these sorts of deaths all too frequently, the excessive use of force by not only prisons officials, but the military and the police officers. So I think it's an important time in Papua New Guinea as it comes up to elections in the next couple of months to consider what the PNG government coming in can do to address that accountability side of things.
And there have been instances where top officials in these security forces have even said that they approve their officers to shoot to kill and have been reprimanded for saying that. But there's obviously a culture, isn't there, amongst some in the force that the value of life isn't that high at all.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here is they're calling the prisoners the undesirables, but in essence it's the police and the security forces who are the untouchables here. They're very rarely held to account when they do commit very serious human rights violations. It's incredibly difficult not only to get internal disciplinary proceedings against officers and to get them dismissed, but even harder still to take them to court for criminal actions that they might be responsible for. And so that's part of the challenges with the law and justice sector in Papua New Guinea, unfortunately.
And how overcrowded are these prisons that people are willing to risk their lives to escape from them?
So the prison that we're talking about here was built to house 400 people, and it currently houses more than double that. And just over half of those who were detained in that facility as of January this year were people who have been charged with offences but not yet convicted by the court.
So prisoners on remand, that people that haven't been proven guilty, and a number of them have been involved in this mass escape.
Yes, That's correct. And we've seen the same happen in previous occasions where even the police have acknowledged that many of those people who have escaped are the prisoners who are being held on remand rather than those who have actually been convicted of serious offences.
Papua New Guinea's police commissioner has defended his decision to engage with an American security firm for training purposes. Gary Backe has confirmed that he is looking at services of the U.S.-based Lawrence Aviation and Security Group to train local forces to provide security at next year's APEC summit in PNG. The presence on PNG's streets of the firm's armed personnel, who are former U.S. military and police officers, has alarmed some citizens. PNG's broadcaster is reporting that the firm's staff are to be deported for the lack of proper clearance. But Mr. Backe told Johnny Blades that they are simply in PNG on a fact-finding mission.
I've asked them to demonstrate their skills. I asked them to provide to me what they can offer to their PNGs in terms of the support, the resource, the manpower, and what they can do to assist the RPNGC if and when we agree to fully engage them, in which case, then it's a subject of government approvals of this.
So it's not set in concrete yet? You're just you're looking at...
No, it's not. You see, the Defence Force is very fortunate because it's gotten present defence assistance that they benefit so well with it. And the RPNGC has got a policing partnership program that we currently have. That program has assisted the RPNGC for us to identify all our gaps in preparing ourselves for APEC. So there was a comprehensive report being done, you know, to the Commissioner for the Australian Federal Police, advising them on what AFP can do and what AFP cannot do. Now, there are four areas of support which AFP will not assist us. One, information technology. Two, cybercrime. Three, intelligence. And four, high-level tactical resolutions on a serious armed incident. All right, so we have to look outside of the box. If Australia cannot give it to me, I must look outside the box to make sure that the RPNGC prepares itself on that matter.
In the meantime, people are a little bit worried about whether these people, if they're on the streets of Moresby, whether they have arresting powers or anything like that. They were reportedly involved in a drug raid.
They are appointed as special constables under the RPNGC. They have every power, but have not exercised those powers simply because they observe some of the activities and some of the behavior of my men on the ground. You know, this constabulary is faced with so much accusation and allegations of police brutality. And that's what they're helping, you know, they're telling us, they're helping us in correcting some of those behaviors as well, too. They don't go to actually speak to our policemen because they will find out that they've actually assisted a lot on the observation, both day and night.
You think they've got a good background? I mean, one of the principals is really just a missionary, isn't he?
He's a missionary. Well, he's an American citizen. They've got law enforcement ticketing. They're also former law enforcement officers and former military officers within the U.S. Army. So,
you're looking for a firm who can help with something that Australian Federal Police or the New Zealand or American Police Force can't necessarily provide right at this point?
Johnny, I was told in the first instance this is where we will get it from. I'm also looking at other countries. You know, if this exercise does not come through, I will go to Indonesia and I will ask Indonesian police to help me. Or I can even go to the Korean police and ask them to help me. Because these are two police forces that I have discussions with them on the side with regards to this matter as well, too.
Transparency International's Papua New Guinea says authorities need to rethink the way correctional services in the country are run. This comes after 17 prisoners were shot dead on Friday during a mass escape that we reported on at the beginning of the program. So far, only three escaped prisoners have been caught, while 57 remain at large. The chairman of Transparency PNG, Lawrence Stevens, told Karori Hawkins there has been an increase of mass jailbreaks in PNG in recent years.
And we are disappointed that we've heard of so many breakouts in recent years. It's a considerable problem because it looks as though there's a challenge either in the budgeting of the corrective institutions or a lack of adequate training, or there could be disciplinary issues. But whatever it is, when you hear that 17 lives have been lost, you then have to start questioning the way in which we're responding as well.
Yes. In past years also, there have been quite a few people that have been shot that have escaped from prison. Is there a, a policy that they just shoot to kill, or are they trying to slow them down, or what's the case? Do you know?
There have been times when people have misguidedly announced that they are prepared to shoot to kill. There's no instruction and there's no policy on that, and anyone giving such an instruction would need to be held accountable before the courts. The reality is, if somebody needs to be apprehended, you have to take every reasonable means to apprehend that person, and no one has the right to simply shoot to kill. And if that were to happen, then one would be expecting to see a very serious reconsideration of what's been going on.
I also seem to recall that there was quite a bit of money invested in improving the fencing around some of these prisons in recent years. Is Boyumo one of those? Do you know? That fence around it looks pretty new.
I haven't been to that prison, and I don't know whether it's one of them. What I do know, though, is it doesn't matter what you do about fences. The main issue is how the people involved in looking after the institution are able to cope. And that's where we tend to fall down.
It's also quite an issue with PNG prisons across the corrections in terms of budgeting, overcrowding of prisons and various things. Is there something that even registers on the PNG political landscape in the lead-up to the election?
I doubt it. It certainly is something that I've discussed with people within the corrective institution service. Because they face this problem on a daily basis. And yes, they say that there is a shortfall in their budgeting and a lack of adequate focus on the needs of the people who are working for the corrective services. That doesn't sound unlikely, because that's the sort of area that we tend not to put enough effort into. And similarly with the police, we certainly don't appear to put enough input into that. When you mentioned earlier spending of money, that's one of the issues again, because sometimes it seems that money is definitely spent on so-called improvements, but the improvements are difficult to actually see and perhaps don't exist.
Yes, and the impact on communities, so many, 77 I think, escaped, 57 still on the loose. Is it always a worry when they get out into communities, or are they taken in by their families or just melt back into the community, so to speak?
That's difficult to judge. One would hope that the families realise that they need to turn these guys back over to the prison system. But it is a tough situation for anybody to be in, having to make that call. The police commander for Morabee, I noticed, made that plain, that people need to make sure they hand them back. And it is important when you're doing that to try to make sure that it's done safely, because there are elements that don't adhere to the law, and that's always a fear for people who have, for one reason or another, escaped from prison and are now trying to find a way to hand themselves in
safely. As you say, you mentioned people who don't adhere to the law. That's actually people within law enforcement that you're talking about.
Unfortunately, we have evidence and many accounts that people within the corrective institutions, within the police and within the Defence Force, do not necessarily abide by the laws that are there to guide us all.
So you, as a prisoner who's escaped, you'd probably be very reluctant then to show up and try and turn yourself back in.
In my experience, that is the case. And in my experience, people would prefer to go through a third party, sometimes a pastor, a priest, or a police officer they know, rather than simply turn up at the gate and say, "Here, I'm back."
The independent East-West Center, based in Hawaii, may be looking at getting extra funding from countries in Asia after proposed budget cuts under the Trump administration. The center's stated aim is to promote better relations and understanding amongst people and nations of the United States, Asia, and the Pacific. But from the end of September, it will lose all of its $16.7 million in government money, although the hope is funding of some sort could be restored when the budget for the next fiscal year gets discussed. At present, the East-West Center gets a total of about $39 million made up of government funding. $14.5 million come from contracts and grants, and $7 million comes from donations and other sources. The East-West Center's president, Richard Vautier, told Philippa Trolley, who has been at the center on a Jefferson Fellowship, the funding cuts, if they weren't changed, would have serious effects on the organization's operations.
The president suggests in his budgets, but the Congress really decides. I mean, it's conceivable that the president could get, assuming that the skinny budget wasn't just a shot across the bow to see what happens, get people shaped up a bit. But it could all go to zero, but I think it's unlikely. But we're not going to take it for granted. We're going to, you know, I think the good thing about the president's, what his approach has been, that every institution in the states really has been challenged by some of the things that the early pronouncements. And in some ways, I think it's pretty healthy. Because if it's same old for decade after decade, it's like, you know, your muscles get flaccid. This kind of frontal attack, and maybe part of his idea, the frontal attack makes every institution, and East-West Center is one of them, rethink its principles, rethink its processes, rethink its priorities. And I think it's healthy. You know, I mean, you kind of do that with planning and so forth, but you got that kind of direct approach. It certainly galvanized a lot of organizations to really look at that. And I think by doing so, I think we're recommitted to our basic mission. We know to your earlier question, what we do today is different from 1970 or 1960 as far as specific programs are concerned and the content. Times have changed, but the basic framework is there.
So the East-West Center has been a fantastic resource for the Pacific when it comes to so many leaders have passed through here. People come here for courses to upskill, and it provides a framework for so many people in the region. If you did lose that funding or some of that funding, or you're having to rethink philosophies or principles, could it have an impact for those that have been used to being able to gain such intense knowledge and networking from the East-West Center?
Well, the immediate impact would be you know, we have to downsize overall our structure because of, you know, I'm unable to afford the number of people we have now. But I think even in that process, and you know, we have those, there's certain basic struts that give our organization institutional integrity. The student program, which has been going for a long time, journalism program, professional development, leadership training, development kinds of things, our Pacific Islands program, and outreach in the arts and also in Washington. Those are things that are really core to the institution. I think it's possible to keep all those things going on a much, much smaller budget, but it'd be much less aggressive as far as the number of people engaged in that. And so it'd be kind of a, as you shrink, it may almost a yin-yang kind of thing where the yin part, the negative part, is you're shrinking. But as you reallocate resources that are left, if you know where to put them on the basic struts that I mentioned, then they will strengthen in some respects, and they could be. Several of them could be. So it would be kind of a growth and shrinkage at the same time, which I think would position us in good stead two ways. One, it's an institution people recognize. It has, you know, not just a name only. The basics are still there. And secondly, it's easier to scale it back up. And I think what we're looking at, of course, is when the center was put together, you know, 57 years ago, a lot of the money really came from the United States. And now, of course, the Asian countries are much wealthier. And I think the resources there on the private and the foundation and the government side may help, you know, may step up to the challenge and help us get through tough times. I'd like to think that anyway, because I think the decades of dedication to the region, you know, maybe it's time for that, some of that, more of that to read down than we have received already.
So there's no chance the East-West Center would close?
Not on my watch. I think there's always a way to find, the good thing is that our basic physical plant, with the current way it operates, the dormitories and our conference center, are pretty much self-supporting. And in some respects, we can, with a bit of tweaking, we can probably generate even a little more income out of those facilities. So the real challenge is the programmatic side. I mean, the research and programs we run that require contracts and grants to do or federal money to do, that is really important to the region. You know, we have contracts and grants at 12 federal agencies, including NOAA, for example, does all this great stuff on the impact of changes in climate to Pacific Islands under, you know, high tides and more or less rain and resulting forest fires or heavy runoff on the streams that fouls up offshore fishing. There's all kinds of things going on in islands in Southeast Asia as well as the Pacific. That, you know, it's a long way from Washington, but we paid a lot of attention to that for a long time. Disaster preparedness is another dimension of that. So I think, you know, I'm hoping that common sense will rule. You just say, cut all that science and technology and education off at the knees and hope things just, you know, muddle along on their own, I think is probably unrealistic. So I think I have great confidence in the Congress to help make that case. We'll do our best. The people we bring here, you know, will have a voice. But also I think diversification of funding to more governments and other organizations, Asia and Pacific-based besides the U.S., is also a very healthy thing to do.
The Tongan Prime Minister made the shock announcement this week that his government is planning to withdraw the country from hosting the 2019 Pacific Games. Early this month, the Prime Minister had expressed confidence that everything was going as planned for the region's flagship sporting event. We have this story from Koro Vakatua.
The Prime Minister says Cabinet met last week and made the decision to pull out of the Games. Mr Pohiva says when he came across a World Bank report, he realised what needed to happen.
The former Minister of Finance, Richard Akolo, he strongly opposed the hosting of Sport Tutonga based on the same report. So when I received the report 2 weeks ago, I copied the report and distributed, and reading the report between lines, I was convinced that there's no other option but to cancel the sport.
Richard Akolo was finance minister in 2012 when Tonga was awarded the Games. But the head of the local Games Organising Committee, Lord Sevele, says the economy can handle hosting the 2019 event, and he doesn't understand why the government wants to pull out. Lord Sevele says the Prime Minister presented the report to the committee, but he says there's evidence Tonga can host the Games successfully. He cites an International Monetary Fund statement which said economic activity is expanding and likely to remain relatively strong, with growth projected at a rate between 3 and 4%, boosted by construction and activities related to the Games.
On the recent reports from the IMF, as late as March of this year, there are painting a very rosy picture of the Tongan economy. The one that the Prime Minister referred to at our meeting last week was one dated 2013. It's out of date.
Lord Sevele says hosting would not pose too heavy a burden on the government, as Tonga would only need to come up with around $13 million.
The funds that will be spent on hosting the Games and the facilities, much of that has been promised from overseas. And also, a fair amount will come from the private sector here by way of sponsorships.
The man responsible for the last budget says more information is needed around the reasons for withdrawing. Asake Eke, who was sacked as minister in March after abstaining in a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister, says the Games could have been held. He says with the assistance of donors such as China and Papua New Guinea, the Games would not have crippled the economy. Dr. Eke says the government needs to explain what will happen to the assistance committed to the event.
Whether they will pull back as a result of cancellations. Locally, we have raised funds through legislation, exchange levy, and also foreign exchange levy, and also legislation for incentive for support from business community. There are a few legislations, and I think that the government have to come out clear what will be the implications of that.
The Prime Minister says Cabinet will decide how the locally raised funds will be used at its next meeting, and he'll talk to PNG about its plans, while China will continue to provide financial help for sporting facilities. While there have been construction delays, financial concerns and contractual disputes, there have also been an ongoing feud between Prime Minister Akilisi Pohiva and Organising Committee Chair Lord Sevele, which culminated in the latter being reinstated by the courts after Mr Pohiva removed him. Dr Eke says this may actually have led to the government move.
they went to the extent of taking it to the court, and the court has come to the decision. I think that's another element. And I guess, you know, that element might have been the basis of the decision, and they probably, you know, use financial situations probably a scapegoat.
The Pacific Games Council only found out about the government plans via media reports. Council President Vidya Lakhan says there may be a small funding shortfall, but plans are already in place to address that.
There are two projects that we had requested the government through the organising committee to put in place. One of them they did. There's some revenue coming in to the Games organising committee through foreign exchange. And the other one, I can't talk about it because it's still in the pipeline. And if those two projects, we would be able to raise a substantial amount of money that we need.
Mr. Lakhan says human resources and very little monetary contribution are required from the government. He says there are other options available and corners to be cut to ensure Tonga remains Pacific Games host. This is Koro Vakauta.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us to let us know how you heard the program or want any more information, it's very easy. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you in 7 days' time, but I should remind listeners in the Pacific region that you can hear a 3 times daily edition on various medium wave and FM stations. So until next time, so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.